Hello, good morning, hello, and welcome to 30 Bad Habits of Server Administrators. I'm Oren Thomas, and I will be taking you through this session. You can follow me on Twitter, should you so be inclined, at Oren Thomas. Unfortunately, I don't post a lot of interesting stuff, usually Lego and spaceships, occasionally advice about server administration. So, I was getting my house fixed about a year and a half ago. And the guy who was fixing my house said, "Your house was built by a builder." And I'd found out a little bit about the history of my house, and I said, "Yes, you're right. That was his job. He built houses." And he says, "Yes, I know. Because builders often live in unfinished houses, and your house, unfortunately, is a bit unfinished. Chefs rarely cook extravagant meals at home. I used to live with my grandmother for a while. She had been a chef, and she preferred simple things at home. Server administrators, people like you, people like me, certainly recognize the idea of good practice. We just don't always get around to implementing it in our production environments. So what this session's like, it's a confessional. It's where we all come into a room and we have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where we admit that perhaps we're not necessarily doing things all right, but that when we leave the session, we'll have turned over a new leaf and we'll be behaving a lot better. Now, why do we as server administrators develop bad habits? Well, ask someone a question and they will come up with a myriad of excuses. Some of ours include that we're practicing reactive server administration. Reactive server administration is simply that, oh my gosh, I've got to deal with this fire now, I'm dealing with it now. I have no ability to plan out how I would like the environment to look, because I'm so worried about just ensuring the environment's going to work on a minute-to-minute basis. We also have what I call an unwillingness to pull on loose threads. That is, we see something and we go, I know that's badly configured. And I know someone's configured it that way. Now, sometimes with bad configuration, it's just bad configuration. And sometimes it's a moment of brilliance that someone has had, and you're worried about pulling on that thread. Of course, because we know sometimes if we pull on a thread, the whole jumper collapses. We don't have time. We're bad, we're not good, we're ordinary server administrators because we simply don't have the time to be amazing server administrators. If we had all of the time in the world, we could sit there, we could conceptualize the problem, we could put things together, we could develop a plan of action, we could take it to management, we could explain in beautiful slides what we were going to do, and we could have this pristine, amazing environment where everything was like Swiss clockwork. But we don't have that. We're basically rushed, we're overpressured, they're getting us to do so many things, and we don't have time to put things together. This is a good one. This is why a lot of this happens. This is only a test machine. It will never, ever, ever be deployed in production. Oh, buggers, they've put it in production. I didn't do it. Macca did it. Everybody works with a Macca. I didn't do it. Wasn't me. Who on earth did this? And I chose that name, not because I thought he'd actually be standing there, but because a certain person, when troubleshooting a demonstration at TechEd New Zealand, went stuff it and disabled Windows Firewall to make sure that something got through it. That's... I love you, Macca. You're wonderful. I'm in so much crap. Okay, your business considers it a low priority problem. Or, put another way, management keeps prioritizing silly rubbish that stops us from doing our jobs. Now, why is it important for you to ensure that you do not continue to perpetuate these bad habits? Security. Security is a wonderful word. You saw Brad Anderson talk all about it in the keynote yesterday. A large number of attacks succeed simply because of poor security configuration. We saw that slide where they were talking about the Defence Signals Directorate, where they were saying if people had done four things, then attacks wouldn't have succeeded. So many attacks occur because of low-hanging fruit, simple things that should have been done that weren't. 30% of attacks come from insiders. We have a perception of security, of being everybody evil is out on the other side of the firewall. You work with your co-workers. You know these people are evil. 30% of your attacks are going to come from people inside your organisation. I want you to think about the generation that's coming in to IT, coming into your environments now. Okay, my 13-year-old is a year 7 at school. They know how to download a VPN client for their iPads that have been given to the school, and they bypass the school system. In fact, as someone said yesterday, there is nothing more motivated than a 12-year-old that wants to get around an application blocker. These 12-year-olds in 10 years are going to be your new hires. They are going to be experienced or at least somewhat knowledgeable about getting around security systems. It's not like you're dealing with aging baby boomers who don't know where the any key is and have broken their cup holder. Administrators, and this is the other scary secret, are often in a position to carry out attacks without being caught. If you look at some of the biggest breaches that have occurred, if you think of the name of Edward Snowden, you think of other administrators, they're the ones that get in and do an amazing amount of damage. And we also know, if we're being completely honest, that as server administrators, we're not necessarily the most mentally well-balanced individuals. It's not just that you've got evil server administrators. Privileged accounts for an attacker are grail items for people with nefarious intent. It's more effective to hack the nerd than it is to hack the system. All you need to do is compromise an administrator or an administrator's machine, and then you piggyback on that to get out throughout the system. So this is another reason why it's important for us to sit there and go, well, look, I'm a good person. Well, yeah, I'm sure you are. I'm sure you're wonderful. I am sure that when you are judged, when you move on to the afterlife, they're just going to tick the box and move you right through. But there's other people who might be trying to sort of tailgate on your goodness to get access to things they shouldn't have. Stuff that you might consider to be really low priority detritus may actually provide an attacker with a route into your system. You sit there and you think, well, this can't be important. That exhaust port just below the main port couldn't possibly be a problem. Luke Skywalker comes along. Darth Vader and the Emperor have got a bit of a bill for some capital equipment. You also don't want to end up in a meeting explaining to someone why you didn't do something that in hindsight, and in hindsight it always looks obvious. You just don't want to explain, well, yeah, we should have done that, but okay, you don't want to be in that meeting. You want to be on a beach in Tahiti. You want to be playing golf somewhere. I know someone at least in the audience wants to be playing golf. You don't want to be in that meeting explaining why you didn't do something that's really obvious that you should have fixed. So let's talk the specifics of some bad habits. Service accounts with passwords that do not expire. Is there anybody here who would like to confess their colleague's sin in this area? Yes, right, exactly. A single service account used for every service in the organisation. Anybody else had that brilliant idea? A service account, or all service accounts in the organisation, using the same default password that's configured to not expire. It seems like genius when you're doing it. This happens because service account password management is tedious. It's boring, it's awful, it's something we don't want to do. But getting your security right is tedious. Security is not all really handsome guys that ride jet skis and get around in GTRs. It's all about sitting there and making sure that every little screw's tightened, every little lock is checked. Now, your solution to service accounts. Well, there's a thing called a group managed service account, and some of the sessions have sort of mentioned these. And what a group managed service account is it's a special type of account that you create in Active Directory, and then you install the account on a local machine. And what happens is that Active Directory worries about managing the password for that account. It goes out and it looks at your password policy and says, right, I've got to rotate the password every 21 days. And it will rotate the password, but because it's installed in that special way, it will also ensure that the machine upon which the password, the service account is installed, also gets that updated password. So the idea of a group managed service account is here's a service account you can assign to a service where the password is going to be managed by the system. For those of you that are taking pictures, that's wonderful. Unfortunately, I'm in them. But remember that all of this is going up on channel9.msdn.com within a week, and so will the slides. So yes, you can take pictures on your phone, but all of this information is available for you later on. So you install it, and then the other thing you can do is you can lock down the privileges. And we'll talk about service account privileges a little later. But it does require Server 2012 Plus. There's a limited version available in Server 2008, and it has a degree of compatibility, but really it's one of those great reasons to start moving towards Server 2012 R2, because hopefully you've all banished from existence the bane of your existence, Server 2003. Anybody here willing to admit their colleague's sin in still having Server 2003 deployed? Yes, that's not unusual. About 30% of the room. Who here has a support agreement with Microsoft for their Server 2003 servers? Wow, there's about 10 of you. In New Zealand, it was two people out of a room of 600. Virtual service accounts are simply a local version of a group managed service account. So if you've got an account that only needs to be on that machine, it doesn't need network access, use a virtual service account. These, again, have been around since 2012. So all the newer versions in 2012 of Microsoft's products support virtual service accounts and group managed service accounts. SQL defaults to using those. Okay. Now, password management for service accounts isn't the only problem we've got. Who here has seen a service account that might have been added to the domain administrators group? It happens. Yes, yes, look, we're admitting. Okay, no one's judging in this room. We're not judging. Yeah, we are judgmental. We're server administrators. But we're all colleagues. Okay, we judge users. We don't judge other server administrators unless we're cleaning up their mess, and or if it's the person that was working before us and who left the organisation, then to say that we're judgmental is really understating. Rant, rave, insane rambling, maybe a better description. Service accounts that are made members of the local administrator group. This is bad. You're not meant to do that. What you're meant to do is you're meant to figure out what privileges something needs and assign them those privileges. Not, get out the biggest hammer I've got and just hammer that in, because that'll get it done. And it will get it done, just won't get it done in a real good way. Because the thing about service accounts is that people who are attacking your network know that a service account is likely to be poorly configured, because they know what we all suspect, which is that we all have a bit of bad practice when it comes to service accounts. So when you, remember I said, what you're trying to do is you're trying to hack the administrator. Well, if you can get to a service account, no one's really paying attention to where the service account's logging on, what it's doing. If a service account's doing something weird, you're kind of like, service account, what can you do? That's why attackers know to use them to leverage their way through your systems. Now, why does it happen? It's really quick, it's easy. It can take time. Remember I said security's tedious. It takes time to get service accounts right. Sometimes vendor documentation is rubbish. Your vendor documentation says, oh, I'll configure this policy, and it'll work. You do that, and it doesn't. And you sit there and you go, wow, it's 9 p.m. on Friday. I could get this working properly, or I could add it to the local administrators group, and now the product works, I'm going home. Do the hard work to make least privilege work. And it is hard work, and that's just part and parcel of the job, unfortunately. More bad habits. Administrator account passwords that are configured to never expire. Who here uses an admin account where they haven't had to change that password for a while? Whose colleague uses that? Yes. Isn't it amazing how the normal users have to change their passwords every 42 days? But the domain admins don't. It's sort of like if you've got the power to turn off this annoying thing, you turn it off. For burying accounts, you can search for accounts quite easily with non-expiring passwords. It's one line of PowerShell. Search AD account, password never expires. It'll give you a list of every account in your organization where the password's configured to never expire. Once you've got that list, you decide what you're going to do with it. Now, whose day-to-day account, that is their non-privileged account, just happens to be a member of the local administrators group on their workstation? Anybody here have a colleague that does that? Everybody else has got a login with a low-privileged account, but I need to install software occasionally, so we're going to break the rules a little here. Even though everyone else in the organisation doesn't have that right, and they don't have that right because that's good security practice. But again, what there was one of the documents released when Eric Snowden dumped all those documents talked about the NSA's technique for going and hacking organisations. And what they said is go and target the administrators, because the administrators will do all of these dodgy things that will make it a lot easier to hack the administrator than it would be to hack a normal user, simply because administrators tend to overprivilege themselves. Use policy to limit membership of the local admins group. Make sure you don't disable this policy for you or your team just because it makes things inconvenient. Security is often at odds with convenience. It doesn't mean that if you make something really inconvenient, it suddenly becomes more secure. That seems to have been the fault that the Americans have sort of fallen into. Let's make airport travel really inconvenient. That'll improve security. Maybe, probably not. TSA has apparently not foiled any plots whatsoever in the last 14 years. And when they actually go and test the TSA, they find that it's not all that difficult to actually get guns and bombs through. Problem, derelict administrator accounts. Who here has looked through Active Directory users and computers and seen the account of an administrator who has long since left the organisation? Yes. This happens for a reason. Who here has looked through scheduled tasks and scripts and thought, I have no idea what that does? The solution is to tear off the band-aid, disable the account or the task, and to see what happens. Because if you can't look at it for a while and you don't know what it does, that's a problem. It's not a, oh, figure it out. It's something you've got to deal with. It could, in theory, be someone who's nefarious has gone in there. It's probably just Macca, did something a couple of years ago. The amount of things, the amount of hacks that people put in place and then forget about is amazing. There's people that go and deploy machines and forget about them. Virtual machines, and I'll talk about that in a second. So, what do you do? If you can't figure out what it does, because it's poorly documented, at some stage you are going to have to deal with it. Procrastination is only going to save you so long. Realize that you need to be proactive about this. Sometimes process needs to evolve so that a do something and wait for the screams approach can be leveraged. So that's really bad process normally, but at a certain point you don't want to be waiting months where you've sent out an email. Who knows what this does? No one comes back, right? If no one comes back, guess whose job it is to figure out what it does? Yours. And if you can't figure out what it does, that's when you might turn it off to see who screams. Because it's obviously, you know, any sufficiently advanced systems administration is indistinguishable from magic, right? So you've got to figure out what it does. Search for accounts that haven't signed on for 90 days. It might be 180 days in your organization, but what you've got to look for is not only server administrator accounts, but any user accounts. If you've got user accounts sitting in Active Directory that aren't being used, is that good security practice? No, because if it's sitting there and it's not being used, you're not watching it. And that suddenly makes it a great vector for penetrating your organization. An account that isn't being used can be disabled. And that's a good way of finding out if there's going to be any screaming. You disable the account, and if you hear a scream, well, you know that someone is using that account. You haven't deleted it. It's not an unrecoverable action. What you are doing is you're slowly turning the volume down to zero and seeing if anybody notices. Use of a domain admin account to sign onto a local workstation. Who here has a colleague that logs on to their everyday work laptop with a domain admin account? Anybody? No. Oh, we're getting very shy now, aren't we? This is bad. It's like using a building master key to lock and unlock your office. Yes, it works, but if you lose your key, what happens? It means that every key in the building, every lock in the building can be opened by someone that finds that key. Whereas if you're using your own individual key to open your own individual office, oh, for the days when we all had offices where we could lock the door and we weren't living in that sort of open plan dystopia that seems to have been sort of forced upon us. Now, why is it bad to sign into your computer with a domain admin account? Especially as we've got this sort of mantra of use your administrator workstation to go out and manage these machines. Well, just because you're using your workstation to go out and remotely manage other machines doesn't mean that you can't launch your admin tools with alternate credentials. What I'm saying is that your signing onto the computer account shouldn't be a domain admin, and it shouldn't be a local admin. That when you need to elevate privilege, you elevate privilege for the specific task that you wish to perform. So there's a thing called a pass the hash attack, which, how many people have heard of it? Okay, so what a pass the hash attack does is it someone gets onto your machine or gets software onto your machine and it goes in and it gets tickets or it gets basically cached credentials of someone on that machine and it's able to use that in a replay attack to gain access to other machines. And the attacker is able to authenticate against a remote server using the underlying hash of the password. They retrieve the hash of a domain admin account from a locally compromised computer and then use it to spider across the network attacking other servers. They basically pick up these cached credentials and they can throw them at other servers. And then bang, oh, I've got a domain admin account. Bang, I can get onto that server. Bang, I can get onto that server. Bang, I can get onto that server. So solutions to pass the hash are actually challenging to implement without using newer technologies. And it's very, very difficult to guard against using new current technologies. Simply, what you need to do is you need to minimize the number of accounts that have wide-ranging privileges. You need to get rid of, and I'll talk about this in a sec, those sort of Green Lantern, those Superman or Supergirl accounts that can do everything. And ensure that accounts are only used on hosts where they need to be used. Windows 10 and Server 2016 are including a new technology called Credential Guard. Now, Credential Guard requires a TPM and it requires the ability to virtualize. And what it does is it creates a special virtualized container that can't be accessed by any other process. So that if someone comes on and tries to pass the hash attack, it doesn't matter what credentials are cached on that machine because they're cached in this special encrypted virtualized, almost like a virtual container or a virtual machine that nothing else has access to. And that means that they can't be spat across the network to get access to other things. But most of you, of course, aren't running Windows 10 or Windows Server 2016. So your option is to restrict the use of privileged accounts. You can use account properties to say, this account can only sign on to these machines. Because what you want to do is you want to move from those generalist accounts that can do everything to specific accounts that can only do specific things. Again, instead of a master key, keys for specific locks. You can also restrict account sign-on times. One of the things an attacker will try to do is just as a matter of their own operational security, they will try and attack you when you're not watching. And obviously, if you're at work at 10 a.m. in the morning and you notice something strange, that would be a bad time for an attacker to attack. Whereas if it's happening at 2 a.m. when no one's actually looking at what's going on, that's a more likely time for an attack to occur. So if you simply say, right, I've got these keys that only open these special locks, and these keys can only be used during business hours, that again ramps up the difficulty for your attacker. Security is never about absolutes. There's no single solution that is invulnerable. What you do is you simply make things more and more difficult for someone who's attacking your network and hope that they go and look somewhere else. Applying all the privileges. So this is what I mean. There's a tendency to add accounts we know that require privileges to the domain admins group. There are many domain admins group that have more accounts than anybody actually knows. There's who here has worked at an organization where there's help desk support people accounts, yes, there's at least one of you, in the domain admins group. Yes, right? Now, I worked at a place where I had a CIO that my manager reported to, and the CIO went to my manager one day, this is way back in 2000, and said, I manage you. And my manager said, yes. And you manage the server administration team. And he said, yes. And he said, well, the server administration team can do things like change passwords and all of that. And he said, yes. And he said, well, I should have exactly the same permissions as the server administration team. Because I am in charge of you, and if I can order them to do it, why not just give me the permissions anyway? And that was his logic. And that was great until he brought his son in one Saturday morning, and his son logged in to a workstation and then started renaming user accounts with creative expletives. Ask yourself, go and look at the domain admins group. Should all of the accounts that are in this group be here? The answer is probably not. Does your organization have a solution for controlling the membership of sensitive groups? Who here has a solution for controlling the membership of sensitive groups? Right. A couple of you, but most of you don't. The multi-role admin account, the Swiss Army knife admin account, it can do everything. It's really convenient because you only have to remember one password, and of course that password is configured to never expire. You've got a domain admin account that's also a SQL Server administrator account. That's also a configuration manager administrator account. It's also your Exchange administrator account. It's also your Azure administrator account. Does anybody work at an organization where this may have happened? Exactly. If an account is compromised, all of the roles that it has privileges to are also theoretically compromised, because the chances are that you're not going to discover that an account is compromised until it's been compromised for quite some time. The lead time on breaches is months, in some cases years. So you simply won't know what that account has been used to do unless you've got really good auditing. And to actually figure out, there are attacks going on now, and there are attacks, if you've got a really good attacker, they're really good at cleaning up their steps. And the other thing to remember is, remember I was talking about my 13-year-old. They know how to use Bing, because of course they're going to use Bing. And they can use Bing to go and find hacking tools, because you get someone who is an extraordinary hacker, and they go and build a whole set toolkit that the 13-year-old only needs to click a few options on and click OK. I do some work for Pluralsight. Some of Pluralsight's most popular courses involve people using things like Kali Linux to penetration test. You go and look at YouTube and have a look at hacking tutorials on YouTube. There's a substantial number of screaming 13-year-olds getting really excited about stuff on YouTube teaching hacking. I don't necessarily suggest that their advice is any good, but what I'm saying is that don't assume that the people attacking you actually have to be technically sophisticated or have NSA-level skills, because you can make someone go fast by putting them in a car, you can make someone into a fairly good hacker by giving them a great set of tools where they just have to point it at the destination and press a button. No account lockout policy for administrators. Administrator accounts should have lockout policies. If someone is trying to compromise this account, disable it and then turn it on. Because if an account's getting locked out, you've stopped an attack. You've put some more security in there. If you don't have a lockout policy, if someone can keep just trying to guess passwords and guess passwords and guess passwords and iterate and iterate and iterate and iterate, eventually they will get lucky. If an admin account incorrectly authenticates three times, doesn't matter, three times in a row, and it usually with an account lockout policy, you say, well, three times in a row in half an hour. No, just say three times in a row, lock you out, and they'll come and have a look at you later. Weak administrator password policies. There's some organisations who simply do not put complex password policies in place for their administrators. So administrator accounts have really bad passwords, like password. I was talking to some people in New Zealand where their policy, organisational policy, was people put the domain admin credentials into Sysvol to allow them to replicate so they could be easily found. This is not unusual. There are a lot of people who say, this is just a temporary fix to deal with problem X, and then they forget about it. And the only time they remember about it is after everything's gone down the tubes. Privileged accounts should have long, complex passwords that need to be changed on a regular basis. If you don't do that, you're making your system weaker. There's a new technology coming in Server 2016 called Just-in-Time Privileged Access Management. And the way that this works is, with 2016, it's going to actually require a separate forest and use of Microsoft Identity Manager. But the idea is that when you need to perform a privileged operation, you actually request through MIM the ability to elevate, and then you're given privileges for a certain amount of time. So let's say that you want to go and add a new Exchange server, or you want to go and add a bunch of mailboxes to Exchange or a mailbox database. You go to MIM, you request those permissions are assigned to you for the next hour. After an hour, those permissions expire. And this is the way that we're going in future, that rather than an account being a domain admin account for all time, it will be more. I've got this account. I want to make it a domain admin account. Okay, it can be a domain admin account after approval occurs for 30 minutes. After 30 minutes, it turns back into a normal account. Now, Azure Privileged Access Management, there's an Azure AD session on in the next day or two. Azure Privileged Access Management, Azure's got this built in already, although this is in a trial version of Azure. And so what you do is you specify who the people are in Azure AD who can request operations to perform administrative operations in Azure. And then what happens is that someone goes and requests that, and then they get a phone call from Azure to their registered device saying, did you request elevation? And if they say yes on the phone, we could press one to say yes, then they elevate their privileges for half an hour. Now, the idea there is if your account gets compromised and someone then goes and tries to do something with it, you're going to get the phone call saying, do you want to elevate? And you're sitting there going, no. That makes it more and more difficult to attack. It will make account hijacking far more difficult. They might hijack the account, but what will happen is that they won't be able to elevate privileges. So what we're doing is we're moving towards a model, and of course we know that if it happens in Azure, it's going to gradually filter its way down where appropriate into the on-prem operating system. So don't be surprised if eventually it starts to go that way, because we're getting to the stage where this sort of prompt for credentials and, you know, or provide your phone code means that you've got two-factor authentication, because it just makes sense. We're seeing Windows Hello, we're seeing all of these alternate authentication technologies that can make your system more secure. Now, Enterprise Random Password Manager is another tool that does this. This is a tool I reviewed for Windows IT Pro a couple of years ago, where simply what you would do is that you would request an account that would do something. So you'd say, I need a domain admin account, and it would give you the credentials for a domain admin account. You'd go and use them, and you can use this right back to 2003. You'd request those credentials. You'd be given the credentials, and they were time-based credentials. So you could use them for a predetermined amount of time, say 90 minutes. And then what would happen was EPRM would then automatically go and then change that password to something you didn't know. So it would lock out the account and you couldn't use it until you went back and checked out the account again. And the idea was that you had specific keys that you sort of had to go to a box, and I want to get into room 14. You go to the box, you get room 14's key, and you've got a code or a code to get into room 14. It's only going to work for 90 minutes. After 90 minutes has expired, that code on room 14 changes. And that's how EPRM works. Now, the future is also a thing called Just Enough Administration. If you're a bit of a junkie on the Channel 9 tech talks, you'll have seen Jeffrey Snover talk about this. So the idea with Jia is that you create a PowerShell, a special PowerShell endpoint that allows only specific operations to occur. So you say, I want to go and perform these operations on Exchange. What the endpoint will give you is it will only give you access to the specific commandlets that allow you to perform those operations. Because at the moment, if you log onto a computer with a privileged account, you can basically do whatever you want as long as you've got permissions, but you can see all of the other commands. With Jia, you can't even see anything you can't do. So the idea is I'm going to give you this power for this amount of time, because you could put it in with just-in-time administration, to do only these things. When that expires, you can't do it, and you can't bust out of that box. You've got a box where you can do what you want. If you want to go and do something else, you have to request an account that has the ability to go and do those other things. Again, it's about limiting what administrators can do, because what's been picked up certainly and become a lot more important to organisations, especially with things like Edward Snowden, is the amount of damage that an administrator can do to an organisation. They have control. And that's a security problem. We've sort of accepted it for 30, 40 years as the state of affairs. But the reality is that things are going to change. And in the next few versions of Windows, or as Windows evolves, as they figure out the way that we're going to do releases going forward, expect to see more of this. You know, we're going to give you this privilege for a certain amount of time, and we're only going to allow you to do this. We're not going to have, add yourself to the domain admins group, and then you can do everything you want. So, disabled Windows firewall. Who here, when solving a problem like Macca did, just went, stuff it, I'm turning off Windows Firewall. Has anybody in the room ever met anybody that might have done that? Yes. In fact, I have the PowerShell command for disabling Windows Firewall programmed into my Razer gaming device so that when I'm working with VMs and I get frustrated, I can just go click, click, bang, done. Okay, but I'm only working with lab VMs because I'm writing books. It's certainly easier to turn it off and figure out than it is to figure out how to create the right walls. Because what happens is you go, I wonder if Windows Firewall's causing this problem. You turn it off, oh, it works. Do you turn it back on? Or do you just keep going? Sometimes you turn it back on, you try and create a few rules, and sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. The way that you get around this is you turn on firewall logging, and they text file logs, and you simply look at where the hits are coming in, and you go, oh, port 3812, okay, I'll turn that on. You create a rule for that, and then suddenly you've got firewall on, your traffic's there, and it might have simply been your setup documentation that was a bit problematic. GUIs on servers that don't need GUIs. This is another one that you'll probably hear a bit about at this tech ed, and certainly it's something that Microsoft's going to be talking about full volume into 2016. That is that Microsoft really wants to, and there's a guy named Jeffrey Snover. Who here knows who Jeffrey Snover is? Okay, a small number of you. Jeffrey Snover's basically the lead architect, or probably the lead architect of not only Windows Server, but System Center as well. And he is passionate about getting GUIs off servers because he says servers shouldn't have GUIs on them. Because the moment you put a GUI on something, you need to apply a heck of a lot more operating system patches to it, but it also requires a heck of a lot more system resources. And the reality is that there are a lot of servers in your organization that are doing boring things like being a domain controller, being a DNS server, being a DHCP server, being a file server, that don't require those servers to actually have GUIs. So you can improve your security by simply removing those roles that are not required. GUIs increase the attack surface, because what you don't want to have is you don't want to have a domain controller hit by an exploit that works against Internet Explorer. Because a domain controller shouldn't actually need to use Internet Explorer on a domain controller. So the solution is NanoServer, which we're going to see with Server 2016. And Server Core, which we've already seen. Now, Server Core is just, it's got most roles, but it just doesn't have the GUI on top. NanoServer is something that runs in a few hundred meg of RAM, has a few hundred meg of disk space, and in the long run, it's the future of Windows Server. Because what you will do, instead of installing a full version of Windows Server to function as a domain controller, what you'll do is you'll build a NanoServer image that will function as a DC, and it'll be really small, it'll be really resource efficient, and then you can deploy that on a virtual machine. And it will only have the components required to function as a domain controller. So anybody attacking that can't use anything unless it's domain controller related. And that's the way that we're going. And there's a few talks at this session about NanoServer. Web browsing on a server. Has anybody ever web browsed on a server? On a domain controller? Yes, don't do that. If you need to get software onto a server, don't open up the web browser, okay? So what happens is people get servers, they launch Internet Explorer, they get that message about Internet Explorer enhanced security configuration, they close Internet Explorer, they open Server Manager, they click Disable IESC, then they open that again, right? There's a reason that that was the default, and the default was don't run a bloody web browser on a server. There's another solution coming forward, OneGet or Chocolaty. That is, it's a, like, for those of you who are Linux fluent, it's like apt-get for Windows. What it does is it allows you to pull packages from a repository and have the software automatically installed. And you can do it from PowerShell. What you do is you set up a central repository in your organization or you use one out on the internet. You put all the software that you need and then you can just use PowerShell to pull it across and install it. Comatose physical servers, comatose virtual machines. There was a report that came out at the start of the year that found that in some data centers, up to 30% of workloads were comatose. Comatose simply meant that they weren't being used, that they'd been deployed into production and that they weren't experiencing anything other than maintenance level operation. That is, that they were doing enough to keep themselves running, but they obviously weren't involved with a workload. And there's a reason that this happens, simply because it's so easy now to go and spin up a virtual machine. Or as some people found, a friend of mine, Jess Dodson, was working on looking at getting rid of Server 2003 from her environment. And one of the things that she did, she went out and she talked to people in her business and she said, hey, who owns this workload? And sometimes she found that no one owned the workload. How do we get there? Well, it happens. People go and get you to do something and they forget about it, because once you've deployed it, it's not your problem, it's their problem. And this happens with virtual machines. So you need a good monitoring solution in there to determine if a workload is comatose. That is, that it's a solution that's been deployed, that someone's, the project's ended, or there's a million reasons for this to happen. But unless you've got a good monitoring tool, you might not be aware of it. I know that I worked at a place where there was a Spark server sitting, that someone had deployed Solaris, and it was the only Solaris box in the organisation. And no one had any idea what it did, but everybody was really afraid of removing it because the guy who deployed it had been an absolute gun as an administrator. So we figured it must do something really important. He'd spent $15,000 getting this server hardware, which is not a lot, but you know, it seemed a lot when I was working at the University of Melbourne. Turned out we didn't know what it was for. And we eventually shut it down and we found out that it wasn't for anything. But it looked really cool. Monitor your VM, monitor your server. Get an idea of which ones are using and which ones are not using resources. And if it looks like it's not using a resource, that's a thread to pull on. Derelict computer accounts. There are many computer accounts where you've gone and decommissioned the computer, but you've left the computer account in AD. Any sort of account that's left in AD that's not being used and won't ever be used again should be removed, because those accounts can be pathways into compromising Active Directory. It might be that someone decides to, for example, rejoin another machine using that name. If the machine's account's not meant to be there, get rid of it. You can use a PowerShell script here, and it's get AD computer filter where last password reset is 365. And that will tell you every computer that's sitting in AD where it hasn't synchronized with the domain for more than a year. That's an interesting one to run, because you're probably sitting there when people go and decommission servers, they decommission computers, they go and delete the computer, or they might just take it off someone's desk and throw it in the dumpster because it doesn't work anymore. But do they go and deprovision the computer account? Probably not. Orphaned GPOs. There's people that create GPOs for a specific reason and then it's forgotten about. And then suddenly Active Directory, you're looking at Active Directory users and computers, and there's all these GPOs here and you only know what about 70% of them do. And again, if you're seeing something where you're not sure what it's for and you're really the person that should kind of know, that's not good. And you can kind of go, I see no evil, I hear no evil, I speak no evil. But if you see stuff that's sitting there that shouldn't be there, don't procrastinate about it. Try and do something about it. Okay, pull on those threads. You can use a tool like Advanced Group Policy Management, which is part of MDOP, to improve your group policy workflow. That way you know who's created the GPO, who's checked it out, who's done something, and what the point of the GPO is. Because you should be able to look there without running a whole lot of reports and understand what group policy is used for in your organisation. Ad hoc OU structure. A lot of organisations have basically just built OUs as they've sort of come to it. There was a lot of weird advice when Windows 2000 came out about how you should go and name OUs. And then what happens is you end up with the same directory, and over OUs, people come up with other schemes for doing OUs. And what you end up is with a highly complicated structure that makes no sense to anybody. So the way you do it is you flatten it and you simplify it. Work out what your OU structure should be and revisit it, because it's likely that your organisation goes through reorganisations far more often than your OU structure does. I've seen OU structures for where there's OUs for departments that no longer exist. For you see branch office sites that haven't been there for 10 years, but they're all sitting in Active Directory because no one's going to pull on any of those threads. Derelict security groups. Security groups get created for a particular purpose and people forget why the security group's there. If you've forgotten why the security group's there, you've got to find out. If you don't know, again, that's one of those things and think, well, I probably should do something about this. Because again, if someone's attacking your system, they will go and create security groups. But they'll name them innocuous. What they're not going to say is, this is the elite hacksaw group that I'm going to use to take control of the universe. What they will do is they'll say, you know, accounts Glenn Waverley. Okay, hackers are clever. They know how to be chameleons on your network. So if something is not clear, again, pull on those threads, figure out what's going on. Audit group usage and remove unused groups. Derelict files. This one is not as much of a security issue, it's just a maintenance issue, but it's a security issue in terms of your backups. The reality of how files are used is that files are really intensely used within a certain period of their creation, and it varies depending on the organization. But once a stop file reaches a certain age, in many organizations, it may not be touched again. You may have files sitting on your file servers that haven't been opened by someone for 2 years. What you should have is you should have a policy on how to deal with those so that they're just not taking up storage. You can go and move them somewhere. You can use File Server Resource Manager, which is built into Server 2003 onwards, so you've got it on your Windows servers, to actually just go through and say, you can say, go and find me every file that hasn't been touched by anybody for 180 days. And File Server Resource Manager will go through and go, here's your list. Then you decide what you're going to do with it. But the reality is, if no one's touched it for half a year, the probability that it's ever going to be touched again is actually really low. There will be cases where they'll go, oh, there was a file there that was there 2 years ago. Can you go and find it? And it's like, sure. I will now go to my backup and I'll restore from backup. But there's no point you storing terabytes of files that no one's ever going to use again. Lack of recovery drills. Who here has a recovery plan? Who here has done a recovery drill in the last 180 days? Point taken. You don't know your data is protected until you can verify that you recover it. Before Microsoft came up with DPM, they found that when they tried not only backup but restore operations, this is back in about 2003, they were getting a 17% failure rate. That means that 17% of the time, they couldn't actually recover the file that they thought they backed up. Either because the tape had been damaged at some point when the backup had been written, or the recovery set was damaged, so that one tape out of however many was problematic on recovery. You've got to know how reliable your systems are, because what you don't want to do is you don't want to be in the situation where you're going to perform a recovery and then you find out that your recovery plan was rubbish. Unwillingness to document, lack of configuration documentation, lack of change documentation. It's said that systems administrators have the same enthusiasm for documentation that a four-year-old has for a tetanus injection. You have to describe your environment, because it's not just you who has to know about it, it's the person after you. Pay it forward. Make sure that people can understand. Okay, a lot of these things that I'm talking about is you dealing with stuff where people haven't explained what this is for, what this scheduled task is for, why that person has been added to that administrator group, why this server has been configured in a particular way. If that's documented, that's good, because we know that attackers are never going to get sophisticated enough where they're going to write fake documentation for you. I mean, imagine that. The documentation fairy comes into your network and documents stuff. Sounds a lot better than the tooth fairy. Ensure your environment is documented so it is comprehensible to someone as equally intelligent as yourself. And I know your systems administrators, and I know you're a bit like Sheldon, the brightest person in the room. But try. Don't treat your new OS like you did the old OS. I see a lot of administrators when I'm training who come in and I'm showing them, so 2012 R2, and they're still doing it the same way they did it in Windows 2000. That is that they think of Windows Server 2012 R2 as Windows 2000 that does a few extra things that they'll get to eventually. learn what the new OS does and implement those. Server 2012 R2 is a far more secure operating system than Server 2003 or Server 2008. In fact, Server 2016 is even more secure. And it's only by going through and looking at those improvements that you can start to have a plan to implement those security improvements in your environment. If you say, look, I'm just going to put it in and I'll just think about it like I thought about the last one, it'll work, but you won't be taking advantage. Like File Server Resource Manager, I was just talking about, how many people knew that there was a tool built into Windows Server that could actually tell them if a file hadn't been accessed for 180 days? Okay, so about half of you. So half of you didn't know, and that's been there for 13 years. Your solution is training. I don't care how you get trained. I don't care if you go to a CPLS. I don't care if you go to Pluralsight and watch videos. I don't care if you buy my books. Teach yourself how to use the new operating system and assume that there is a reason for a new operating system other than Microsoft just wanted to have something else to talk about at TechEd. Ignite. Ignored event logs. Who here has ever opened Event Viewer and gone, there's a couple of yellow ones, but no red ones. Clear log. Most breaches have involved months of network reconnaissance. Hostile activity was present in the target logs for months prior to the biggest credit card breach in history. For those of you who didn't hear, this attack was wonderful. What happened was a bunch of hackers from Eastern Europe used an air conditioner, a HVAC employee's credentials to get onto the target network. And what they did is that they went through and they first reconned to the network. And then they designed some very specific malware. And what Target did is a security measure would redeploy the operating system at each point of sale terminal overnight. So what these very clever little people did was that they went and put malware into the deployment image that got pushed out every night to the point of sale terminal. And they made the malware identify itself as a Dell RAID controller. So what would happen is every time the malware would be detected, it would say, Dell hardware controller detected. So they had reconned the network to the point where the IT people, the security administrators, were simply like, we think that this is a false positive. And we're coming up, and when they activated it, it was brilliant. They activated it about this time. And we know that we've got Black Thursday, which is the biggest retailing day in the United States. And literally the security team at Target was given the option of you either admit that every point of sale terminal in the country is compromised the day before we have our heaviest retail day, or we hope that it's not. And they hope that it wasn't, and that's why it's the biggest credit card breach in history. Administrators ignored the breaches as false positives. They didn't go and look, they didn't go and pull on those threads. Maybe it's impossible for them to do it, but in hindsight, all of the evidence was there in the logs. And that's the other thing. Remember, you don't want to be in that meeting where someone comes to you and said, we've done a breach analysis. If you'd opened Event Viewers and actually clicked on one of those yellow ones, I mean, God forbid we do that, you would have actually seen that this attack was happening. Understand what you need to respond to. And you need to understand the difference between what is suspicious and what is merely anomalous. And you have some of the greatest tools in history to allow you to search and discover what information means. It's not like back in 1995 when I sort of started as a server administrator, and if something went happened, I could go and ask someone on Usenet about it, but there certainly weren't the sort of search engines that are available today. Figure out what's anomalous, what's suspicious, what should you have been alerted to, what clues would Sherlock have picked up if he'd been looking through your logs. Don't use the same password for your work and your private accounts. Work email, which increasingly means work credentials, and passwords are often exposed in breaches. Okay, so a person in the room did a bit of an analysis on some of the Ashley Madison breaches and found an extraordinary number of organisational accounts in the Ashley Madison breach. Now, I'm not entirely sure if the Ashley Madison breach actually had password data in it or not, It did. Okay. So who here suspects that anybody who was stupid enough to sign up to Ashley Madison using their work account would have been smart enough not to use the same password for their work account and their Ashley Madison account? Okay, do you see why I'm talking about this? Your solution is advanced threat analytics in Azure, which now detects whether AD Azure accounts turn up in a breach, or there's Troy Hunt's haveibeenpwned.com, which you can sign up for. I'm not sure if you've got an organizational level subscription or anything like that. He does. So you can sign up your organization for haveibeenpwned.com. And if an account associated with your organization turns up in a data breach, you'll be notified about it. Hard-coded IP addresses. We've got them in scripts. We've got them in applications and settings. Get rid of them, because you move stuff around to different IPs, but if you don't get rid of them, things break. You should be using fully qualified domain names. I mean, there's a reason that we haven't adopted IPv6, right? And the reason is people look at IPv6 and go, right? We're meant to use DNS names. But no one is, because we're so used to thinking in IP addresses. And the people who designed IPv6 are like, no, you don't need to remember that. Go and use a DNS name. Well, go and use a DNS name, because that means that you can move stuff around. It's a bad habit to hard code IP addresses into anything. And a lack of administrator auditing. We know the phrase. Who here can translate the Latin for me? Anybody? Quis custodiet ipsos custodes? Who watches the watchman? Who is watching you? Are you watching how administrator accounts in your own organization are being used? If you use some of the new Azure tools, they will provide all of that for you. And there's more and more tools out there that you can get to watch, because you want to see what suspicious administrator activity is going on. The NSA, if they had had that for Bose Allen Hamilton in Hawaii, they would have picked up on what Edward Snowden was doing a long time before he was doing it. Well, no, not before he was doing it, but they certainly would have picked it up before he got on a plane to Hong Kong with several laptops full of confidential data. In summary, I have talked about probably more than 30 bad habits that server administrators have. Some of these you will have. Some of these, of course, you're perfect and you won't. But what I want you to do is I want you to think about your own environments and how you can make them that little more secure and that little more efficient. I will take... Please make sure you fill out your evaluations. If you've got questions, come down the front, because you guys don't have microphones. Other than that, thank you very much for your attention.